Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. I am a PGY1 transitional year resident going into radiology. This is the 83rd episode of the Divine Intervention Podcast, and in today's episode, we'll be continuing our discussion of HemOnc as a review for the USMLE Step 1 exam. I'm almost certain that we'll have one more podcast, and after that, actually, I'm certain we'll have one more podcast, and that'll be the final one. So, Part 6 will be the final conclusion of HemOnc for the USMLE Step 1 exam. And I apologize, I haven't made podcasts in a while. I'm on a busy medicine rotation, and I've had a ton of patients the last few weeks. So it's just kind of hard, right? So, but let's go ahead and begin. So, and there are actually attached slides for this because I wanted to employ certain like testing strategies with this particular episode, because I feel it's particularly important to be able to differentiate certain things that I'm going to discuss today. And this podcast is floridly high yield for the USMLE Step 1. I can almost promise you probably get like 6-7 questions just from this podcast alone. So, question 1. We have a 23-year-old male being treated for resistant schizophrenia that becomes febrile. Okay. His white count is 700 with 50% neutrophils detected on CBC. And then I have a closely related vignette here. About a 34-year-old female has proptosis on physical exam, and she has new onset AFib. So I really hope that for the first person, right, so you're like, oh, they've got schizophrenia. If you've got resistant schizophrenia, it's not responsive to treatment. I really, really hope you're thinking about, okay, you've tried haloperidol, not working. You've tried many of the other atypicals, not working. So you're jumping into the land of clozapine. Remember, clozapine is one of two psychiatric medications that has been shown to decrease the risk of suicide. That is actually very high yield to know for the USMLE Step 1. It decreases the risk of suicide. The other one is lithium, that's used for bipolar disorder. So clozapine, right? Remember, one high yield side effect is agranulocytosis, right? So this person basically has a neutropenic fever, because if the white count is 700 and they have 50% neutrophils, 50% of 700 is 350. So if they have a neutrophil count less than 500, right, you're worried about a neutropenic fever. So the next thing you want to do is basically, this is more for step 2 CK, you want to start them on a drug that covers Pseudomonas, right? So you'll likely use piperacillin and tazobactam, or you can use an aminoglycoside or like gentamicin, or you can use ceftazidime, that's a third generation cephalosporin that covers Pseudomonas, or cefepime, that's a fourth generation cephalosporin that covers Pseudomonas, or you can use you can use your monobactams like Aztreonam, or you can use your carbapenems like meropenem, ertapenem, imipenem, doripenem. Those all cover Pseudomonas. So that's, I guess, a nice review of our Pseudomonas. So, I mean, pseudomonal coverage, right? So again, if a patient has a neutropenic fever, you want to cover Pseudomonas. And then the other vignette I'm giving you is basically a person that likely has Graves' disease, right? They have hyperthyroidism. I remember hyperthyroidism, one of the most common causes in the U.S. is Graves' disease. Remember, that's where you have like thyroid-stimulating immunoglobulins that attack the TSH receptor on the follicular cells of the thyroid gland, right? So they have the proptosis. I mean, you've probably seen those scary pictures in textbooks. And then they also have like new onset AFib. Remember, it's actually very high yield to know this. The most common arrhythmia in patients with hyperthyroidism is AFib. That's actually a very high yield concept that's tested on the USMLEs, right? So why would they have a neutropenic fever? I really hope you're thinking about the anti-thyroid medications like PTU or methimazole. Remember that both of those medications actually can cause agranulocytosis as a side effect. So you basically need to watch white blood cell counts when patients are on those drugs. Now, so those patients have neutropenic fevers. And again, they essentially have like, you know, like basically just think of them as having like some kind of think of it as like a bone marrow suppression sort of deal, right? So the big concept I'm sort of talking about with these two things, right? So I talked about two situations where people have like low white counts. The thing is, people that actually have like clozapine toxicity or PTU methimazole toxicity, they could actually occasionally have scenarios where you actually suppress their entire, like all their like hematopoietic cells, right? So they may have like low white cells, low platelets, low red cells. That is rare, but that is certainly possible, right? So basically the big concept I sort of want to talk about here is like aplastic anemia, right? So remember, aplastic anemia can be caused by many things, right? So it can be caused by drugs, right? So you're thinking about like your anti-thyroid medications, you're thinking about your clozapine, right? Remember, those things can cause aplastic anemia. Also, don't forget like certain viruses, right? Remember your poster child. In fact, it's probably the only single-stranded DNA virus you need to know for the USMLE step one. But that happens to be parvovirus B19, right? Remember, it can cause like the slapped cheek rash in kids. And remember that classically on the USMLE, it can show up as like a lady that works in a daycare that has like weird like joint complaints. And remember that it can also cause like hydrops fetalis if kid has like congenital like parvo B19 infection. And also don't forget, right, people with hemoglobinopathies, right, so like sickle cell disease and whatnot, they can get like an aplastic crisis in the setting of parvo B19 infection, right? So that's another thing that can cause aplastic anemia. If you look at the second vignette where I talk about like a 12-year-old male that has over the last few weeks developed like massive generalized lymphadenopathy and hepatosplenomegaly, and then a flow cytometric studies reveal a 15-17 translocation. So obviously, you know this is acute promyelocytic leukemia because you've listened to the previous podcast that I just gave. And then I say that, you know, he's been transfusion dependent all his life, and physical exam is notable for the absence of the right thumb. That's kind of weird. Okay. And his head circumference has always been in the second percentile, right? So this person basically has a microcephaly. Right. So what's your diagnosis? Right. So this patient has developed AML. Right. That's why it's called acute leukemia. Right? It develops over a relatively short period of time. And actually, for these things, you want to treat them relatively quickly because they actually, acute leukemias, especially when a person has like a blast crisis, they're usually like rapidly fatal. So you don't want to sort of like mess around and sort of stew around with acute leukemias for the most part. So this person has AML. Right. And they've developed this AML in the setting of, basically, the way I set up this question is they've had like a chronic condition and then somehow they've gotten AML as a result, right? So this question I'm referring to, I'm essentially talking about Fanconi anemia, right? So remember, Fanconi anemia, right, the classic way it will present on MBMEs is kids may have like Café au lait spots, right? So remember, Café au lait spots are not always caused by endocrine disorders. They can also be caused by hematologic disorders. And the key one you want to know is Fanconi anemia, right? So Fanconi anemia can cause Café au lait spots. Usually those kids tend to have like thumb abnormalities. And then in addition to that, those kids tend to have like very tiny heads, right? So like microcephaly, and they are at increased risk of like many hematologic malignancies, right? So those are kind of like high yield things you want to keep at the back of your mind. So this child has Fanconi anemia, right? And remember that Fanconi anemia, right, the pathophysiology arises because, or let's put it this way, it basically arises because people have issues with like double-stranded DNA repair, right? So I believe I may have talked about this, or I will talk about this in one of the cell biology podcasts, where I talk about like how you can use like homologous recombination. It's one of like these high-yield mechanisms behind like double-stranded DNA repair. And if you have problems with those, that's how Fanconi anemia presents. In fact, in general, if a patient has Fanconi anemia, if you expose them to something that an agent that sort of puts a lot of stress on DNA, the classic one is like mitomycin. So let's say you're trying to like grow lymphocytes, in the presence of mitomycin that places a lot of like stress on DNA, you'll notice that these people have a ton of like chromosome breaks. Right, if you're doing those specific studies in the presence of mitomycin, that's one of the ways that Fanconi anemia is actually diagnosed. So don't forget, skin problems, thumb problems, small head, increased risk of hematologic malignancies, think about Fanconi anemia. Please don't confuse Fanconi anemia with Fanconi syndrome. I'll talk about that in a bit, right? So again, this first slide basically is just talking about aplastic anemia. So just sort of keep all these things at the back of your mind. And again, remember when I talked about like primary myelofibrosis, right? In one of the earlier HemOnc podcasts, I said that primary myelofibrosis, those people will also have like a dry, will have like a dry tap when you do a bone marrow aspiration, and they have like those teardrop shaped red blood cells. Same thing arises with aplastic anemia. You'll also have a dry tap when you do like a bone marrow aspiration, but in general, I'll say for the USMLEs, do not associate aplastic anemia with teardrop-shaped red blood cells. So I think that's all I want to say for this slide. And I mean, obviously, right, because if a person has aplastic anemia and they're not making enough red blood cells, you would imagine that their reticulocyte count should be low, right? It should be pretty low. And in addition, right, because they are not making red blood cells, how do you think the endothelial cells that constitute the peritubular capillaries of the kidneys would respond? I would really hope that you're saying, you're like, oh, wait, there's no red blood cells here. Let's spike up our production of erythropoietin, okay? So just sort of keep those things at the back of your mind. So I think, I feel pretty good about this slide. So let's go ahead and move on to the next question. So the next question says, a 13-year-old immigrant from Athens, right? So it's a place in Greece. Or if you're an NBA fan, remember the Greek freak, right? Giannis Antetokounmpo. So pretty great a basketball player. Probably be the successor to LeBron James. But that's a different story. Let's come back to the real world. So 13-year-old immigrant from Athens is brought to a pediatrician to establish care. Basic labs obtained are notable for a hemoglobin of 9. He's asymptomatic. A blood smear is consistent with the findings shown below. So my question, what is your diagnosis and what is the pathophysiology, right? So I am really, really hoping that you recognize on this image that we are looking at target cells, right? And if we're looking at target cells, that means we are very likely referring to a thalassemia. Although remember, target cells can be found in like liver disease. They can even be found in many other diseases, right? But usually for the USMLEs, you want to think about thalassemias first. You want to think about liver disease second, okay? If you see target cells. So, but one thing, right, that you've probably heard me mention is that in general, for the USMLE exams, the pictures are not absolutely necessary for you to get a question right, right? So basically, if they give you geography in an MBME question, they're trying to tell you something, right? If they mention like Greece, right, you're like, this person probably has like some kind of like thalassemia, likely like a beta thalassemia, right? Because beta thalassemias are very common in people of Greek ancestry. I'm trying to see if there's any other like Greek association for the USMLEs. G6PD deficiency, right? So it's also associated with Greece, right? But that's besides the point. But again, if you did not have the picture and I just said Greek person, anemia, microcytic, first thing that really should come to your mind is a beta thalassemia, okay, like a beta thalassemia minor, for example, right? So, and the classic finding, right, on imaging, on a microscopy, right, if you do a blood smear, and these are target cells, right, so you see red, like pink in the center, a white rim around it, and then pink on the edges of the red blood cell, right, that's classic for a target cell, kind of looks like a bullseye. So the thalassemias, right? So obviously, right, you should hopefully know that your thalassemias, right, there are two kinds of thalassemias, right? So there's like alpha thalassemias, there's beta thalassemias, and the alpha, I guess let's maybe spend some time talking about some nice pathophys here, right? So let's talk about the beta thalassemias first, right? So the beta thalassemias, basically it arises when you have issues with making globin, right? Remember, hemoglobin is made of heme and globin, right? So if you have troubles with making globin, then you will have troubles making hemoglobin. And if you're not making hemoglobin, right, you have an anemia, right? You have like a microcytic anemia sort of picture, okay? So in general, right, you get like beta globin gene. The beta globin gene, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, is on chromosome 11. So, and usually you get like one chromosome 11 from dad and one chromosome 11 from mom, right? So if you have mutations in one gene, right, you have something called beta thal minor. If you have mutations in both genes, you have something called beta thal major. Okay, and for the USMLE, it's actually high yield to know that the most common mutation that causes beta thalassemia for the most part is a mutation with like the process of alternative splicing. Okay, just one of those weird high yield things you want to keep at the back of your mind. And the thing is, there are actually like a crap ton of mutations that cause beta thalassemia, right? It's like there's probably like, I don't know, like 70, 80, 90 different mutations that can cause beta thalassemia. So if you really think about it, because this is one very nice way they can tie this with cell biology on step one, right? It's like multiple different kinds of mutations that can give rise to one phenotype. That's something known as like, especially like at the same gene, right? So it's like oh, like little mutations here and there, but they're all in the same gene, but they can cause the same like phenotypic presentation. That's something known as like allelic heterogeneity. Okay, so it's like, oh, the alleles, because remember, right, two copies of the same gene are known as alleles, right? But those alleles, you can have like multiple different mutations in them that can cause a lot of, that can cause basically the same troubling presentation. Think about that concept, allelic heterogeneity. That's a very nice way they can actually test that on the USMLE step one exam. So that's it with the beta thalassemias, right? But there's a few more things we should discuss here, right? So I said that you get one chromosome 11 from mom, one chromosome 11 from dad. The one chromosome 11 from mom and the one from dad basically tells you that you have two genes total, right? So that's why you nook one gene, you have beta thal minor, you nook two genes, you have beta thal major, right? And the thing is, classically, to diagnose these hemoglobinopathies like beta thalassemia, right, the thing you want to go ahead and do is something called a hemoglobin electrophoresis. And the thing is, if you're dealing with beta thal minor, on hemoglobin electrophoresis, you have an increase in hemoglobin F, right? But that is actually not diagnostic. I'll say the thing that's more diagnostic for beta thalassemia is an increase in hemoglobin A2, okay? In fact, let me tell you this. This is floridly high yield to know for the USMLEs. If a person, okay, has an increase in hemoglobin A2 on a USMLE, on any USMLE exam, doesn't matter, step one, step two, step three, you should have a very good reason for not picking beta thalassemia minor, okay? You should have a very, very good reason for not picking beta thal minor. So remember your different hemoglobins, right? So hemoglobin A is like alpha 2, beta 2. Hemoglobin A2 is alpha 2, delta 2. Hemoglobin F is alpha 2, gamma 2, right? So the reason why your hemoglobin A2 will increase in the setting of beta thal minor is that you don't have as much in the way of beta globin gene chains, right? So other kinds of hemoglobin that do not depend on the presence of a beta globin chain will begin to spruce up, right? So you have more hemoglobin A2, so alpha 2, delta 2. You actually have more hemoglobin F, alpha 2, gamma 2, right? But the big thing you want to look for in exams is an increase in alpha 2, delta 2, right? Hemoglobin A2. And let me ask you a quick question. Do you think a person will have hemoglobin A detected on hemoglobin electrophoresis if they have beta thal minor? I really hope you're saying yes, right? Because remember, if you have beta thal minor, one of your beta globin genes is still working. So you're still making some beta globin, okay? So you still make some hemoglobin A. So you have like, you still form your alpha 2, beta 2, so some hemoglobin A, right? And the reason I'm asking this question is that if you notice, if hemoglobin electrophoresis shows you increase in hemoglobin A2, increase in hemoglobin F, and you still detect hemoglobin A, so that's normal hemoglobin, that tells you you're dealing with beta thal minor. However, what if you see an increase in hemoglobin A2, an increase in hemoglobin F, and you are not detecting hemoglobin A? If you see those hemoglobin electrophoresis results, I am really, 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 really hoping that you are thinking about beta thal major, right? Because in beta thal major, your two beta globin gene chains are screwed up. So if they are both screwed up, you're not making any more beta globin. So if you're not making any more beta globin, you will not be able to make any kind of hemoglobin that depends on the presence of a beta globin chain. Basically hemoglobin A. So no hemoglobin A, but your hemoglobin A2 will go up because hemoglobin A2 does not contain beta globin, and your hemoglobin F will go up because your hemoglobin F does not contain a beta globin, right? So again, you need to be able to interpret these hemoglobin electrophoresis results for your exam. They are very, very high yield to know. And then your alpha thalassemias, right? So your alpha thalassemias. So the thing is, think more about chromosome 16 versus the chromosome 11 we talked about for the beta thalassemias. So think more about chromosome 16. And the thing is, you actually get two genes from each parent for your two like alpha globin genes from each parent, right? So it's like two from dad, two from mom, both on chromosome 16, right? So you basically have like four alpha globin genes, right? So again, keeping with our theme of thalassemias, where it's like, oh, you're not making enough globin gene chains. If one of the four genes is screwed up, you have some mild anemia. No one really cares. Not clinically significant. But if you lose two, you begin to care, right? That's like alpha thal, many people call it like alpha thalassemia trait, right? So those people have like some anemia, you can detect it on labs, but they are not things that people you know, classically get like super symptomatic from. However, there is one high yield key thing you want to know for your exams. The thing is, right, so I said that there are four total alpha globin genes, and I said if you lose one, no one really cares. If you lose two, there are actually two different ways you could lose two, right? So you could lose both genes from one chromosome, or you could lose one gene from one chromosome, so one gene from like dad's chromosome 16 that you have, and one gene from mom's chromosome 16 that you have, right? So if you're losing both genes from the same chromosome, so let's say, oh, both of the alpha globin genes on that chromosome 16 are knocked out, that is the cis kind of alpha thalassemia trait. But if you're losing one alpha globin gene from dad's chromosome 16 and one alpha globin gene from mom's chromosome 16, that is the trans alpha thalassemia trait. And it so happens that the trans alpha thalassemia trait is actually, the clinical presentation is usually not as severe as the cis alpha thalassemia trait, right? So remember your cis and trans, right, from organic chemistry, like your cis alkenes and your trans alkenes. Let's shut down that organic chemistry discussion. I don't want to give some people nightmares, but basically the cis alpha thalassemia trait tends to be more severe than the trans alpha thalassemia trait. And the thing is, the trans alpha thalassemia trait is usually found more in like Africans, right? So if you see like a Ghanaian or a Nigerian with alpha thal on your exam, you really want to think about the trans alpha thal trait, right? So if they have alpha thal trait and they're Ghanaian or Nigerian, think about the trans kind of the alpha thal trait, right? Versus a person that's like from Vietnam or like some kind of like South Asian population, you want to think more about the cis alpha thalassemia trait, and that tends to be a little more severe. And the thing is, if you really think about it, what do you think would potentially happen if two people with cis alpha thal trait get married, right? So let's assume you have like two people, they get married, and let's assume that unluckily the deformed chromosome 16 from mom that is missing both alpha globin genes is transmitted to the fetus, and then the deformed chromosome 16 with both alpha globin genes knocked out from dad is also unfortunately translated to the fetus. Basically, that fetus will have a defective chromosome 16 from dad with the cis alpha thal issues, and a defective chromosome 16 from mom with the cis alpha thal issues. So guess what? That fetus will not have any alpha globin genes, and guess what? That fetus will not be born. Why is that? Because that fetus has something known as hemoglobin hemoglobin BARTs, right? So that's basically where you've lost all four alpha globin gene chains, right? So basically those kids will have like gamma 4 hemoglobin, that's called hemoglobin BARTs. It's not compatible with life. Those kids would likely die in utero, right? So contrast that with a kid that loses 3 of the 4 alpha globin gene chains. That's called hemoglobin H disease. They tend to have like very severe anemia, okay? And that severe anemia basically arises from birth. And that's where you want to be careful, right? Because people may be like, Divine, why is that important for exams? Here's why it's important. The thing is, beta thal minor, right? I said that, oh, beta thal minor arises when one of your... So remember I said, when I talked about beta thal minor, I said like, okay, one beta globin gene is screwed up, right? So they'll have like anemia, right? But the thing is, and then in beta thal major, they lose both beta globin genes, right? So people with beta thal major, they actually get severe anemias, right? And they sort of become like transfusion dependent. But it's actually high yield to know that their symptoms do not start until after 6 months. Because remember, you have a crap ton of hemoglobin F at birth, and it sort of persists for about 6 months. So you don't really get symptoms, right, at birth with beta thal major, because you are not heavily dependent on hemoglobin that needs beta globin genes, okay? But if a person has like hemoglobin H disease where they've lost 3 alpha globin genes, right? Those people will have severe symptoms from birth because hemoglobin F itself requires alpha globin genes, right? Remember, hemoglobin F is alpha 2, gamma 2. So patients with hemoglobin H disease have problems from birth. Patients with beta thal major have problems from after 6 months of delivery. Okay, so it's again one of those weird things you want to know. So I feel like I've talked about some hair stuff, so let me just summarize this real quick. If you lose one alpha globin gene, no one really cares, not clinically relevant. I mean, yeah, you have some anemia, but no one really cares. If you lose 2, you can lose it in one of two ways. You can lose it the cis way. Think about Asians with that, and that's more severe. And you can lose it the trans way. Think about West Africans, that's less severe, right? And then if you lose all 3, if you lose 3 of 4, you have something called hemoglobin H disease, severe anemia from birth, okay? If you lose all 4, never born, right? That's hemoglobin BARTs, because they are forming gamma 4 hemoglobin, right? That's hemoglobin BARTs. Hemoglobin H is actually hemoglobin that is a beta 4 tetramer, right? Because again, if you have very limited alphas, the betas will begin to congregate amongst themselves, right? So you have a beta 4 tetramer. And then for beta thalassemia, I said that, and I'll say this in general, hemoglobin electrophoresis is not useful for alpha thalassemias, okay? There's reasoning behind that, but I don't really have the time because I don't want this podcast to be too long. So I'm going to move on because there's other important things I need to cover. But hemoglobin electrophoresis is awesome for beta thalassemias. And I said in beta thal minor, they'll have an increase in hemoglobin A2, an increase in hemoglobin F, and hemoglobin A will still be detectable on hemoglobin electrophoresis. Contrast that with beta thal major, where they have an increase in hemoglobin A2, an increase in hemoglobin F, and hemoglobin A will not be detectable on hemoglobin electrophoresis. And the reasoning behind that is because if you have beta thal major, both beta globin genes are gone, so you're not making any beta globin. So any hemoglobin that depends on the presence of a beta globin gene is not existent, right? Like hemoglobin A, which is the case in point. And remember that your thalassemias, remember, like you're off, they're inherited like in an autosomal recessive fashion. And again, particularly prevalent in like Africa, right? Because it's kind of protective against like malaria, right? Against like Plasmodium infections, right? And I mean, there's many theories behind that, but in general, like red blood cells that have a lot of like hemoglobinopathies, they tend to associate more with immunoglobulins, right? And if you're associating more and more with immunoglobulins, you're more likely to like be protective against bugs that attack red blood cells, like malaria in this instance. And not that you need to know the mechanism or anything like that, but just remember that association. And yeah, I think that's all I'm going to say with regards to these thalassemias. Don't forget your target cells. And remember that your thalassemias are a kind of microcytic anemia, right? And usually, for the most part, iron studies are, you know, pretty normal with thalassemias. I mean, obviously, if a person has a severe thalassemia, you give them like blood transfusions, but that blood transfusion can also cause like a secondary like hemochromatosis. So those people occasionally may need like iron chelator therapy, right? So like deferoxamine or like deferasirox. So yeah, I think that's all I'm gonna say. That's all I'm gonna say with these thalassemias. So let's go ahead and jump to the next slide. So this versus that, right? So again, this is super high yield for the USMLEs, right? So the first one, I've kind of talked about it already, right? I say that this person has Café au lait spots, right? But in addition to having Café au lait spots, they have problems with their thumbs, right? So they have like thumb abnormalities. So let's say like a hypoplastic thumb or an absent thumb, and then their head circumference is in the second percentile, and they have pancytopenia. So what do I mean by pancytopenia? By pancytopenia, I mean that all their cell lines are down. So their red blood cells are down, their white blood cells are down, their platelets are down, right? If you see this, you want to think about Fanconi anemia, okay? Microcephaly, small head, thumb problems, Café au lait spots, and all your cell lines are down, think about Fanconi anemia. Okay, now the next vignette says facial anomalies plus thumb issues plus pure red cell aplasia, right? So notice these people also have problems with their thumbs, but they have like craniofacial abnormalities versus like the skin problems and the microcephaly that are found in Fanconi anemia. But notice the only cell line that is down are their red blood cells. Their white blood cells, their platelet counts are just fine. If you see this, you really want to think about diamond black fan anemia. Basically, it's like some issues with like their red blood cell precursors. So they have like a pure red cell aplasia, usually around the age of two. You just notice that, man, these people's hemoglobin is like super low. And I mean, it's basically like a mutation in like some proteins you need for like your ribosomes, like your eukaryotic ribosomes. So you essentially don't make red blood cells right. And it's, I mean, like, it's not a great condition, but it's not as fatal as the many genetic disorders, like the biochem disorders where like, oh, this person has like this evil, like lysosomal storage disease. So just sort of keep that at the back of your mind. So the only thing, again, if you see thumb issues, but the only cell line being down are the red blood cells, you really want to think about a diamond black fan anemia. And again, it arises because you have issues with your red blood cell precursors, because you have like ribosomal protein mutations, and it's actually a cause of macrocytic anemia. So like your MCV will be greater than 100, right? Now notice the next question: short stature, skeletal anomalies, malabsorption secondary to pancreatic insufficiency, and neutropenia. So notice here, the cell count that is down are just your white blood cells. If you see this, you want to think about another hematologic problem. It's known as Shwachman-Diamond syndrome, and the way Shwachman is spelled is it's spelled as S. Let's see. Let me think about this for a second. I think it's SH. Let me look this up. Shwachman-Diamond. Yeah, the spelling is kind of weird. Shwachman. Yeah, it's SHWAC. HMAN and then diamond, right? So why do you think I'm making a big fuss about this? I'm making a big fuss about this for actually multiple reasons. The first thing is your friends at the USMLE, they'll know that, people may confuse diamond black fan anemia with Shwachman diamond syndrome. They both have diamond in the name, right? And some kind of cell count is down in both disorders. But notice it's your neutrophil count that is down in Shwachman-Diamond syndrome, and it's your red cell count that is down in diamond black fan anemia. Okay, so in Shwachman-Diamond, they have skeletal problems. Okay, and they basically, you need to look out for pancreatic insufficiency. So you may have like fat malabsorption on your test. You see that and you see like a low white blood cell count, think about Shwachman diamond. But if it's only your red cells that are down and they have thumb issues, think about diamond blackfen. And then if all their cell lines are down and they have like small head, thumb problems and like skin, like hypopigmentation or like caffeine or lace spots, think about a Fanconi anemia. And then the last question here says, like, I guess second to the last question says, increased levels of multiple electrolytes in the urine in the setting of a type 2 RTA. I really hope you're thinking about Fanconi syndrome, right? Please don't confuse Fanconi syndrome with Fanconi anemia, right? Fanconi syndrome is a kidney problem. Fanconi anemia is like a hematologic problem. In Fanconi syndrome, you basically have like a global transporter issue in your proximal tubule, right? So you don't reabsorb anything, right? So like their phosphate levels in the urine are high. Everything in the urine is high, right? It's a kind of a type 2 RTA. Remember, a type 2 RTA is a proximal renal tubular acidosis. And then, I guess as an aside, how can you increase the reabsorption of supplemental iron? So let's say you're taking like iron tablets. How do you increase the reabsorption? Basically, you give vitamin, like orange juice, right? So like, remember vitamin C activates... I think it's called like, it's like methemoglobin reductase. So it converts like Fe3 plus to Fe2 plus. Remember, Fe2 plus, ferrous iron is the only iron we can absorb. We do not have the ability to absorb ferric iron, right? So I remember that iron is reabsorbed in the duodenum, right? So yeah, if you take orange juice and you're taking iron supplements, the iron supplements, you just reabsorb more, right? So a very nice way they can test that on the USMLE step one is just to ask about an intervention that will increase the bioavailability of iron supplementation. That will be the administration of anything that contains ascorbic acid, which is vitamin C. Okay. So, I think that's all I want to say in this slide. I'm just trying to think. Is there any other high yield thing I want to discuss here? No, I think I'm good. I feel pretty good about this slide. Okay, again, I have to like sort of think on the fly because I plan all these lectures, but I give them from memory basically. So, just bear with me with these arms and ass. Okay. So, next slide, right? So, we have multiple strokes plus hypotonia in an infant plus elevated methylmalonic acid levels plus hyperammonemia. In fact, I want you to contrast the first question with the second one, where like this person has, the second person has like upper motor neuron symptoms, lower motor neuron symptoms, but notice they're not infants, they're adults. And they also have a history of like other autoimmune problems like vitiligo, and they have elevated like a methylmalonic acidemia, right? So remember, for the USMLEs, there are two things you should, actually, there are only two things you should think about on the USMLEs when you're thinking about the methylmalonic acidemia, right? So one is a B12 deficiency that will very likely show up in an adult. One is from a mutation in like methylmalonyl-CoA mutase that'll be more in an infant, right? And the key things that will sort of help you differentiate is if you see like a newborn or like a very young kid, like, you know, less than 2 years old, having like many strokes, like super hypotonic, and they're having like urea cycle like issues where like, oh, their levels of ammonia are like super high and they have a methylmalonic acidemia, you literally want to think about actually the disease condition is called methylmalonic acidemia, okay? But remember that if you have a B12 deficiency, remember B12 is a cofactor for methylmalonyl-CoA mutase. Remember that converts, if I'm remembering correctly, methylmalonyl-CoA. Actually, I am remembering correctly. I love biochem. So methylmalonyl-CoA mutase converts methylmalonyl-CoA to succinyl-CoA, right? And uses B12 as a cofactor. So if you have a B12 deficiency, you will not have proper activity of methylmalonyl-CoA mutase. So you will not convert malonyl-CoA to succinyl-CoA. So your levels of methylmalonyl-CoA will build up. So you have a methylmalonyl acidemia, right? So if you see a person that has like a macrocytic anemia, right? And do you have a methylmalonic acidemia? You can pretty much stop reading the question on the USMLEs. You are dealing solely with a B12 deficiency. And that will be, again, more likely in an adult. And the reason that this person in the second question has the B12 deficiency is that they likely have pernicious anemia, where they have like an autoimmune destruction of like their parietal cells, right? And it may not necessarily be the parietal cells that are like, you know, destroyed. It can be components of the parietal cells that are destroyed, right? So you may form autoantibodies against intrinsic factor, or you may form autoantibodies against that sodium hydrogen antipodder that you find on the surface of a parietal cell, right? That's inhibited by inhibited by your PPIs, your proton pump inhibitors like omeprazole. You can form autoantibodies against that, and that will cause a pernicious anemia, right? And remember that those if you have B12 deficiency, from pernicious anemia, you can make the diagnosis by checking for anti-intrinsic factor antibodies. There's this test that they used to do back in the day, like the Schilling's test, but essentially no one does that anymore. But even if they don't do that in the real world anymore, it still shows up fairly commonly on the USMLEs, right? So it's just one of those things you want to keep at the back of your mind. So, and the reason that this person in the second question has like the upper motor neuron symptoms and the lower motor neuron symptoms is because they have a subacute combined degeneration of the cord, right? So remember, B12 deficiency can cause a subacute combined degeneration where you basically destroy the dorsal columns in the spinal cord, and then you destroy the lateral corticospinal tract, right? So if you destroy your dorsal columns, right, you have problems with like fine touch and vibratory sensation and proprioception. And then if you damage the lateral corticospinal tract that's in the dorsum of the spinal cord, right, those people will have upper motor neuron symptoms, because remember, your corticospinal tract basically has like upper motor neuron fibers. So next question says like microcytic versus megaloblastic anemia. So remember that a microcytic anemia, right, is just an anemia where your MCV is greater than 100, right? But don't forget that microcytic anemia does not mean megaloblastic anemia, okay? In fact, let me make this clear to you. Megaloblastic anemia is any anemia that is associated with a B12 or folate deficiency, okay? So if you have a B12 or a folate deficiency as the cause of your microcytic anemia, that is a megaloblastic anemia, okay? Think about megaloblastic anemias as a subset of microcytic anemias. Okay, megaloblastic anemias are a subset of microcytic anemias, right? Because there are many other kinds of problems that can cause an MCV greater than 100, right? An anemia where your MCV is greater than 100, like liver disease can do that if you're a booze master, right? So you consume a ton of alcohol, and that can do that. Diamond black fan anemia, right, presents with a microcytic anemia, right? But B12 folate deficiency, they cause microcytic anemias, but if you want to be a little more specific, they cause a megaloblastic anemias, okay? Megaloblastic anemias in general are anemias where you have problems with like DNA synthesis, right? So, because remember, right, if you can't make DNA, remember the first thing that basically like doubles, like when a cell is preparing to divide, right, you double your DNA content, and then you double the cell size, and then you basically cleave the two daughter cells and whatnot. Well, if you can't double your DNA because you don't have B12 or folate, but your cell is like, wait, I'm getting bigger, but where's the DNA I need? Then your cell will not divide as well as it should, right? But because the cell is getting bigger and bigger in cytoplasm, right, obviously your cell then, if it's a red blood cell, it will begin to have like a higher MCV, okay? So that's why you get microcytic anemias in the setting of a B12 and a folate deficiency. Now, next thing here is, I guess, B12 versus folate deficiency. I've talked about this in multiple podcasts. If you listen to any of my podcasts, you probably heard this like two or three times. Remember, both of those things cause, again, megaloblastic anemias, which again are a subset of microcytic anemias. Remember that in B12 deficiency and folate deficiency, you have like a homocysteinemia. So your levels of homocysteine will go up, right? But remember that you have a methylmalonic acidemia in B12 deficiency, but you will not have that in a folate deficiency. And remember that folate deficiency does not cause a neurological deficit. B12 deficiency causes neurologic deficits, right? Like the subacute or combined degeneration of the cord. And then also don't forget that you get folate from plants, right? From like plants. So vegans hopefully don't get a folate deficiencies. And then you get B12 more from like animal products, right? So vegans, especially if you're like an unwise vegan that doesn't take like B12 or supplementation, you can get vitamin B12 deficiency that way. And next question is like iron deficiency anemia versus anemia of chronic disease. So iron deficiency anemia, right, is the most common cause of a microcytic anemia. These are basically both causes of anemias where your MCV is less than 80, right? So microcytic anemias. And the thing is, if a person has an iron deficiency anemia, right, they're just not consuming iron, right? So, I mean, it can arise for many reasons. Let's say you have like super heavy menses, that can cause a iron deficiency, right? And then you get an iron deficiency anemia with that. Anemia of chronic disease, like literally as the term goes, like chronic disease, right? So these people have literally chronic disease. So they may have like rheumatoid arthritis, or they may have I don't know, like cancer, right? Anemia of chronic disease is actually one of the most common anemias in people that are that have cancer. In fact, let me put it this way: the most common cause of anemia in a patient that's in the hospital, if it's microcytic, is anemia of chronic disease. Okay, so again, one of those weird things to sort of keep at the back of your mind. And I guess as a compare and contrast, right? So in iron deficiency anemia, right, your iron stores are down, so your ferritin should be low. Okay, contrast that with anemia of chronic disease where your ferritin is high. Because the thing is, in anemia of chronic disease, you have chronic inflammation, bacteria need iron, so your body is like, well, hello, bacteria, you need iron. Okay, well, I don't want to die of this infection from you. So guess what I'm going to do? I'm going to prevent you from having iron, right? So your body is like, okay, well, for bacteria not to have iron, let's just sequester this iron within like macrophages and enterocytes, right? And the thing that happens is there is this thing called ferroportin. It's a transporter that you find on the surfaces of like enterocytes in the GI tract, on the surfaces of bone marrow macrophages. Right, so ferroportin is basically the thing that takes iron from those cell types. Like, say for example, right, you consume iron and it gets into your enterocytes in your GI tract, and you want to send it to the bone marrow so that your erythroid precursors can make red blood cells. You use ferroportin to sort of make that process happen, right? So the thing that happens in anemia of chronic disease is that if you have chronic inflammation, that will increase the synthesis of interleukin 1 and interleukin 6. When you have those things released, that will increase the synthesis of something called hepcidin. And when you have high levels of hepcidin, the thing is, hepcidin essentially marries ferroportin. And when hepcidin marries ferroportin, ferroportin is then like endocytosed into the cells that have it, right? So like your enterocytes of your GI tract, your bone marrow macrophages. So you basically have iron, but it's just not available, right? So it's just like having like a Great Depression where it's like there's money in the bank, but banks are not open to give you that money, right? So you have iron in the bank, you have iron being stored, but you cannot bring it out for your red blood cell precursors to use it, right? So your ferritin is actually high, your iron stores are actually high in the setting of anemia of chronic disease. And remember that your ferritin has an inverse relationship to your TIBC, right? So the ferritin is high in anemia of chronic disease. So your TIBC, your binding capacity for iron, is actually low in anemia of chronic disease. Contrast that with iron deficiency anemia, where the TIBC is actually high, right? Because think about it. If you're iron deficient, right, you want to try to bind as much iron as possible, right? So you open up more slots, right, for iron to bind, right? So that's why your total iron binding capacity goes up, right? So again, ferritin is low in iron deficiency anemia. It's high in anemia of chronic disease. TIBC is high in iron deficiency anemia, but low in anemia of chronic disease, right? And obviously, if you have iron deficiency anemia, your serum iron will be low. But actually, in anemia of chronic disease, because your iron is sequestered, but it's not like free flowing in the bloodstream for bacteria to use, your serum iron is also low in the setting of anemia of chronic disease. Okay, so I will say that, I mean, there are all the labs and all that crap that they try to emphasize, but you really don't need those for exams. The things you want to look out for in your exams, you want to look out for your ferritin, you want to look out for your TIBC, and you want to look out for your serum iron. And I mean, if you also want to go with transferrin saturation, fine, whatever. Your transferrin saturation, for the most part, is low in iron deficiency anemia, and it can be low or like normal in anemia of chronic disease. So that's not super useful. Focus more on the TIBC, the ferritin, and the serum iron, and that will give you what you need for your exams. And don't forget that your red cell distribution width is actually increased in the setting of iron deficiency anemia. Okay, and then differences in iron folate and B12 absorption is an easy question. Iron is reabsorbed in the duodenum, right? Folate is the jejunum. There's actually an enzyme that helps you reabsorb folate. It's known as conjugase. I learned this from Dr. Golian. Conjugase helps with folate reabsorption. That conjugase is actually inhibited by phenytoin. That's why phenytoin can cause a folate deficiency. And that's why phenytoin can cause like neurotube defects, right? Because you're basically causing a folate deficiency. And then don't forget that B12 is reabsorbed in the terminal ileum. Okay, so let's do some quick experiments here. In step one of this experiment, you essentially have two patients, patient A and B. Both patients, you're like, okay, these people have B12 deficiency, fine, whatever. And then in step two, you give both patients like a super high dose of like IV vitamin B12 to essentially like saturate all their B12 receptors and the B12 stores in their bodies, right? And then in step three, you then give them oral vitamin B12, where you're like, I'm not seeing your B12 in the urine of these two people that I'm giving oral vitamin B12, right? And you would expect normally, under like normal circumstances for like normal people, to see B12 in the urine if you give oral vitamin B12, because by giving that initial high dose IV vitamin B12, you've covered every store of vitamin B12, you've covered every receptor of vitamin B12, right? So everything is all covered, right? So any oral vitamin B12 you're taking, it has nowhere to go, so it just shows up in the urine. But for these patients, you're like, it's kind of weird. I'm giving you oral vitamin B12. I'm not seeing B12 in the urine, right? So I'm now giving you two scenarios, and I want you to make a potential diagnosis for these two patients, right? So let's say for one patient, so you then say, okay, I gave you just oral vitamin B12. Nothing is happening. You then decide to add intrinsic factor. But even after adding intrinsic factor, you notice that, man, I'm not still finding B12 in the urine. That basically tells you that this person has a problem with absorption of vitamin B12, okay? So let's say their terminal ileum may be gone. Let's say, for example, they have like Crohn's disease. Basically, if you have a reabsorptive issue, then giving intrinsic factor is not going to fix the problem, right? Because, yeah, you have intrinsic factor, you have all you need, but you do not have the reabsorptive surface for B12 in the terminal ileum, right? Contrast it with the next patient where you do find B12 in the urine after you give intrinsic factor. So that means, the addition of intrinsic factor to the oral vitamin B12 fixed the problem, right? So that tells you that likely this person had an intrinsic factor deficiency as the cause of their problems, right? So this is more that, like, basically telling that this person has pernicious anemia, right? Because again, giving intrinsic factor fixed the problem. And basically this question I post is essentially the Schilling's test, right? So it's just something you want to be able to reason through on your test. And I guess it's not necessarily on this slide, but I guess I'll talk about it because it's kind of high yield. But I think it's, let's talk about the metabolism of B12, right? So that you can essentially know all the potential causes of a B12 deficiency, right? So if you consume B12, there is something known as R factor. I believe it's like part of the saliva. It sort of binds that B12 that you consume, right? And that B12 with the R factor travels all the way to the duodenum, okay? But in your stomach, we have parietal cells, right, that make intrinsic factor. They secrete that intrinsic factor, and the intrinsic factor on its own doesn't actually bind B12 in the stomach. The intrinsic factor actually travels all the way to the duodenum, okay? But the thing is, in the duodenum, pancreatic enzymes essentially break up that marriage between B12 and R factor, and then that B12 goes along and marries intrinsic factor, okay? And then that intrinsic factor and B12 complex is then reabsorbed through the terminal ileum, okay, into the body. So you can basically see that, and really you may be like, Divine, okay, why the rigmarole with R factor? The thing is, R factor is like a protecting group for vitamin B12. If you're thinking about like organic chemistry, where if you have like I don't know, like a reactive carboxyl group, you can protect it by like converting it to like an acyl ester or something like that. Again, I don't want to give people nightmares, because I'm sure as you start medical school, like, oh, thank God, I never have to worry about OChem again. So I won't bring back those are nasty memories for many people. Okay, so that's why you need that rigmarole with R factor, because it basically protects B12 from like the rough neighborhood of the stomach. Okay, that's why it basically goes all the way with B12 so that's the deal with R factor, right? So so basically, you know the causes of a B12 deficiency, right? So if for example you have pernicious anemia where you've attacked your parietal cells, you get a B12 deficiency that way. Or if you have, if you're taking a proton pump inhibitor, remember, proton pump inhibitors, literally, they cause like a functional parietal cell insufficiency. That also increases your risk of B12 deficiency. If you have a pancreatic enzyme, if you have like a pancreatic issue, right, you're not releasing those pancreatic enzymes, because remember, B12 cannot be married to two people at the same time. No, it's either married to R factor or to intrinsic factor. So if it's married to R factor, well, that marriage with intrinsic factor cannot happen, right? It's like, if you don't take the MCAT, you can't get into med school. So if you don't have if you have pancreatic insufficiency, you do not make the pancreatic enzymes that cleave the R factor from B12, so that can also cause a B12 deficiency. If you have terminal ileal disease, right, so like Crohn's disease or like tropical sprue, that can also cause, or like celiac disease, that can also cause like a B12 deficiency. Also, if you have like, I think it's called like the giant tapeworm, I think it's like Diphyllobothrium latum, if I'm not mistaken, that also loves B12 for some bizarre reason, right? That can also cause a, B12 deficiency. So I really hope you find this slide to be helpful. But again, I promise you, you're going to see these things probably more than 20 times before you graduate from med school, right? So again, one of those high yield things you want to know. So I think I'm going to move on to the next slide. So, next slide says, 33-year-old Greek female presenting with pallor and dyspnea 5 days after starting a 7-day course of nitrofurantoin for symptomatic cystitis. As an aside, why would nitrofurantoin potentially cause lung disease with an increased / normal FEV1 to FVC ratio and a reduced DLCO? And then the second question says, how is the oxyhemoglobin dissociation curve shifted in a patient with pyruvate kinase deficiency? Okay, so in this question, right, so this person, first question, the person took nitrofurantoin, right? The thing is, nitrofurantoin, commonly known in the hospital as Macrobid, it's a great drug for treating cystitis. And actually, for the future, please, for future USMLE exams, please do not choose nitrofurantoin as a drug for treating a pyelonephritis. Nitrofurantoin concentrates really well in the bladder, so it's good for cystitis, but it is awful for pyelonephritis. It's a common USMLE question. Do not pick nitrofurantoin for pyelonephritis. That will result in lower scores on exams. Don't do that to yourself. So back to the real world. So so nitrofurantoin, right, it's a drug that causes pretty severe oxidative stress, right? So if a person, I don't know, maybe has a G6PD deficiency, right? See, Greek female. Hope you're getting my drift, right? So, Greek female, G6PD deficiency, oxidative stress, nitrofurantoin. That oxidative stress, right, can basically put them in trouble, and they get like a hemolytic anemia with that, right? So remember, in G6PD deficiency, glucose 6-phosphate dehydrogenase is in fact the rate-limiting enzyme for the synthesis, for I guess the oxidative phase of the pentose phosphate pathway, right? Remember, that oxidative phase, the key thing you want to know from that is really helps you with making NADPH, right? So if you have a G6PD deficiency, you're not making NADPH from the oxidative phase of the hexose monophosphate shunt, also called the pentose phosphate pathway. If you're not making NADPH, well, guess what? Glutathione reductase will have no cofactors. Because usually what happens is glutathione can exist in an oxidized state or in a reduced state. The oxidized form of glutathione is converted by glutathione reductase to reduced glutathione, okay? And then that reduced glutathione can work with an enzyme known as glutathione peroxidase to help you deal with oxidative stress, right? So like hydrogen peroxide and whatnot, okay? So if a person has G6PD deficiency, they are not making any DPH, and then they are subjected to oxidative stress, they use up all their reduced glutathione, but they have no ability to reconvert that reduced glutathione, to convert the oxidized glutathione you've now formed back to reduced glutathione, because glutathione reductase that uses NADPH as a cofactor is not working. Those people will then have like oxidative damage to their red blood cells. So they'll begin to form things like Heinz bodies, and then when their splenic macrophages see those Heinz bodies, they literally take a bite out of those red blood cells and you form bite cells. Okay, so that's the big thing with G6PD deficiency. And the thing is, for G6PD deficiency, you do not make the diagnosis during the acute episode of hemolysis. You actually wait like 6 weeks after the hemolytic episode has resolved, when the and then you check you then check their G6PD you then go ahead and check their G6PD levels under those circumstances. That's more for step two. But yeah, they love to tempt people with like, oh, check G6PD levels or do a G6PD assay during the acute hemolytic episode. That, again, will result in lower scores on exams. You want to test weeks after the hemolytic episode has resolved. And remember, again, anything that can cause oxidative stress, right? So like primaquine that kills like that latent form of malaria, or fava beans, right? All that stuff. Those can all, or trimethoprim sulfur methoxazole, right? So think about an AIDS patient kind of question on your USMLEs. Or dapsone, think about a leprosy patient kind of question on your USMLEs. Although pneumocystis jirovetii, you can also actually cover it with dapsone, like the prophylaxis, right? So again, those are all different ways they can test G6PD deficiency on your exam. And don't forget that nitrofurantoin can actually cause pulmonary fibrosis, right? So remember, pulmonary fibrosis is a kind of restrictive lung disease. So FEV1 FVC ratio will be like normal or increased, and the reduced DLC, right? Because again, if you fibrose your lungs, you have issues with lung diffusion. I'm really looking forward to giving a POM podcast or like video review in the future, but we'll see how that works out with my schedule. So and then the final question on this slide that says, oh, how is the oxyhemoglobin dissociation curve shifted in a patient with pyruvate kinase deficiency? So let's, again, don't have to memorize anything if you understand, right? So think about it. If a person has a pyruvate kinase deficiency, right, everything prior to pyruvate kinase, which is the last step of glycolysis, will begin to back up, right? So like phosphoenol pyruvate will back up, and then 1,3-bisphosphoglyceride will back up. And the thing is, 1,3-bisphosphoglyceride can be converted to 3-phosphoglyceride. That's one pathway. But it also so happens that 1,3-BPG can also be converted to 2,3-BPG, which is also known as 2,3-DPG, under the action of an enzyme known as BPG mutase. Okay, BPG mutase. So if you have a pyruvate kinase deficiency, your 1,3-BPG will build up. And according to Le Chatelier's principle, because that pathway of 1,3-BPG to 3-phosphoglyceride is all bunched up, then everything will start working from 1,3-BPG to 2,3-BPG. You have more flux through that pathway. And 2,3-BPG, remember, it binds to the beta-globin chain of hemoglobin and basically causes it to have less affinity for oxygen, right? So I sort of think of it as an adaptation in a sense, right? Again, makes biochemical sense. If you're lacking, if you have a pyruvate kinase deficiency and that's making your red blood cells explode fairly frequently, right? You want whatever little you have in the way of red blood cells to be very good at just releasing oxygen to their surroundings. Although that's also bad, because if they're releasing oxygen to their surroundings, guess what they are not doing? They are also not picking up oxygen from the lungs, right? So it's kind of like a double-edged sword. And you may ask, so to answer the question, the oxyhemoglobin insufficient curve will be right-shifted because they are giving up more oxygen. Remember, right, your hemoglobin F has alpha 2, gamma 2, doesn't have a beta globin chain, so they have no ability to bind a 2,3-BPG. Remember, 2,3-BPG binds specifically to the beta globin chain of hemoglobin. Okay, so if you have a kind of hemoglobin that does not have a beta globin chain, like hemoglobin F, then you're naturally left shifted. Okay, just one of those weird things you want to keep at the back of your mind. Now, you may say, okay, Divine, why will a pyruvate kinase deficiency cause anemia? Well, I mean, think about it, right? So, if a person has pyruvate kinase deficiency, remember, glycolysis is the only way red blood cells can make ATP, right? Because remember, red blood cells don't have mitochondria, right? So, if you're, and remember that, remembering glycolysis, you invest 2 ATPs initially, and then you harvest 4 ATPs at the end for a net of 2 ATPs. Right, so the thing is, but remember that those ATPs that you get from glycolysis, they come at two steps, right? So one ATP is made when you convert let's see, so just give me 1 second here, let me think about the glycolysis pathway. So the pyruvate kinase step is one of those steps, and then another step that makes ATP is, so there's pyruvate kinase, so there's the pyruvate kinase step. Come on, Divine, think. So there's a pyruvate kinase step, and actually there is, yeah, the step where you go from 1,3 bisphosphoglycerate to 3 phosphoglycerate. I believe that's under the action of phosphoglycerate kinase. Yep, that is the second step that also helps you make ATP, right? So if you have a pyruvate kinase deficiency, you're stuck. It's like you invested 2 ATPs at the beginning of glycolysis, but the phosphoglycerate kinase step works, so you make 2 ATPs, but the pyruvate kinase step is not working, so you're not making those extra 2 ATPs that gives you your net harvest of 2 ATPs at the end of glycolysis. So guess what? You are effectively not making any ATPs from glycolysis. So, why is that a bad thing? Well, if you're not making any net ATPs, is there a particular transporter that stops working? I hope you're telling me the sodium potassium ATPase pump. If it's not working, guess what happens? Sodium flows down its gradient into your red blood cells. As sodium comes in, what happens to your red blood cells? Water will come in as well. The red blood cells will swell and will explode. So you get a hemolytic anemia that way, okay? It will basically be like an intravascular hemolysis, I guess. And with that, right, you have like the unconjugated hyperbilirubinemia and the jaundice and all that stuff, okay? In fact, pyruvate kinase deficiency is actually one of the most common enzyme deficiency causes of hemolytic anemia. G6PD deficiency is another classic one. Okay. So that's all I think I want to say about this slide. So let's go ahead and move on to the final slide. So this is basically like a test taking strategy slide. There are just certain things I want to, basically, if you see like these kinds of questions, there's like one thing I want you to think of first on any NBME exam. And this slide is helpful for step 1 through step 3. So first question, decreased MCV, Greek national, that should get you thinking about thalassemia, okay? And to be more specific, I want you to think about beta thalassemia minor, okay? Beta thal minor, some kind of beta thalassemia. Next one, decreased MCV, immigrant from Vietnam, okay? I really want you to think more about an alpha thalassemia. To be more specific, in general, think of an alpha thalassemia. But if you're thinking alpha thal trait, I really hope you're thinking about the trans kind, okay? Remember, that's common in Asians. Next one. Decreased MCV, history of rheumatoid arthritis, right? Rheumatoid arthritis is a chronic disease. So I really hope you're thinking of anemia of chronic disease with this. Next one, decreased MCV, history of von Willebrand disease and heavy menorrhagia. I really, 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 really hope you're thinking about iron deficiency anemia, right? So if you have von Willebrand disease, you have a deficiency of von Willebrand factor. So the first step of like primary hemostasis doesn't work. So you just bleed out a lot. So you have like very heavy periods. So if you have very heavy periods, you're chronically losing blood. So you get an iron deficiency anemia with that. Okay. Now, increased MCHC and the genetic history. Basically, if you ever see an increased mean corpuscular hemoglobin concentration on your exam, on any USMLE, there's only one thing I want you to think about, and that's hereditary spherocytosis. Remember, that's an autosomal dominant disorder. So it's transmitted from parents to offspring. That's why, again, they'll say like, oh, dad died of this. Dad's brother died of this. Kid has this. Okay. There'll be a story, the genetic history in the question. Think about hereditary spherocytosis. Remember, those people tend to have spherocytes on blood smear. That's basically a red blood cell without a central pallor. And then they will also have, the pathophysiology involves like spectrin and anchorin defects. Those are like cytoskeletal proteins in red blood cells. Now, if you see decreased ferritin, and that's literally all you see in the question, you want to think about iron deficiency anemia, right? Decreased ferritin. Again, there are many things that can cause decreased ferritin, but you don't care about those things on your USMLEs. The thing you care about is the right answer. And in this case, that's iron deficiency anemia. Now, if you see increased ferritin with a decreased TIBC, you really want to think about anemia of chronic disease or some kind of iron overload state. But more commonly, think about anemia of chronic disease. Now, microcytic anemia, abdominal pain plus low IQ. Abdominal pain, low IQ, this is lead poisoning, right? Lead poisoning, remember, lead, right? If you have a ton of lead, that will inhibit. I've talked about this in one of the early hemon podcasts. But ferrochelatase and ALE dehydratase will not work, right? So these people will essentially have like a sideroblastic anemia sort of picture. And remember, right, if you want to make heme, right, you need iron and protoporphyrin, right? So the thing is, if you're not making protoporphyrin because ALE dehydratase and ferrochelatase are all screwed up, then iron will just keep hanging around. It's like, wait, where is my wife that I want to get married to? Why is my wife not here, right? Because, again, you have these enzyme deficiencies and you're not making a protoporphyrin. So the iron just keeps hanging out. So the labs in lead poisoning actually mirror iron overload fairly well, okay? So basically, the thing that happens is their ferritin is actually high, their TIBC is actually low, the serum iron is actually high, right? Because again, it's almost like iron overload, because you have all this iron, but you have nothing to do with it, because it's like you have iron standing at the altar, because the wife is not there. And their transferrin saturation will actually be high as well, okay? So those are the labs with lead poisoning. Remember, lead, right? If your person has like lead toxicity, you can throw like succimer or dimercaprol or EDTA and all that stuff. And don't forget that, don't forget the association of like moonshining, right? Or like pottery from a foreign country or living in an old home, okay? But really, if you see a kid, and this is very classic as well on the pediatric shelf, abdominal pain, neurologic problems, headaches, think about, really like the only thing you should think about is lead poisoning with that. Next one, increased reticulocyte count, Northern European ancestry. This is, again, hereditary spherocytosis. The retic count will be high because you have a hemolytic anemia. So your red blood cells, your bone marrow will be trying to keep up with the demand by... But, I mean, think about it, right? It's like if you take time to craft a good product, let's say you're a company and you make products for sale and you take your time, everything is handcrafted, it comes out high quality, right? But if you're, like, trying to mass produce things at very high quantity... Then you begin to cut corners, right, in that production process, right? So you begin to make crap, basically, right? So whenever you have a hemolytic anemia, your bone marrow cannot, like, handcraft your red blood cells. So your bone marrow begins to make, like, a ton of crap, right? A ton of like immature blood cells like reticulocytes. So usually in hemolytic anemias, your retic count is actually high. Now, anemia and an increased red cell distribution with, there's only one thing you should think about on your exam, that's iron deficiency anemia, end of story. Increased hemoglobin A2 and electrophoresis, think about beta thal minor. Okay, that's the first thing you want to think about. Thalassemia with in utero demise. So this will be alpha thal. This will be hemoglobin BARTS. Okay, this is where you've lost all four alpha globin genes. This is obviously not a good outcome. And then thalassemia with symptoms 6 months after birth. This is beta thal major, because beta thal minor is usually not symptomatic. So beta thal minor, usually not symptomatic, but yeah. Thalassemia, severe symptoms, 6 months after birth. Think more about beta thal major, okay? And again, you don't get the problems until 6 months after birth, because guess what you have for the first 6 months? Hemoglobin F, which is alpha 2, gamma 2. You don't really need much in the way of beta globin chains, right? So you're fine for the first 6 months of life. Now, thalassemia with severe symptoms from birth, right? So this will be hemoglobin H disease. This is where you've lost three of your four alpha globin genes, okay? Those kids were born, but they have very severe anemias. And again, I've talked about the reasoning behind all that stuff earlier. Now, MCV of 60, positive fecal occult blood test in a 50-year-old male. This is not good, right? This person probably has colon cancer. Remember, if you ever see microcytic anemia in a person more than 50 years old, you're thinking about like a bleeding colonic malignancy, okay? So your next step in management is colonoscopy. Simple as that. And also don't forget, right, other indications for colonoscopy. If you're more than 50, you should get a colonoscopy. If you do a blood culture and you find strep bovis, right, or you find something called a Clostridium septicum in the blood, so Clostridium septicum, strep bovis in the blood, go ahead and do a colonoscopy, because those are associated with the presence of colonic malignancies. Now, MCV of 60 and a 5 month old. So this child is probably like just exclusively breastfed, not getting enough iron supplementation. Because remember, breast milk does not contain a ton of iron, right? So kids can actually get iron deficiency anemia if they are exclusively breastfed. Exclusive breastfeeding is actually great, but you need to supplement some other stuff. That's why you should see your pediatrician regularly if you have kids, right? I mean, you carry that kid for 9 months, went through all that trouble. Probably makes sense to see a pediatrician regularly. Okay, back to this. So, MCV of 60 with difficulty swallowing. Okay, this is a tricky one. Microcytic anemia, difficulty swallowing. I really hope you're thinking about Plummer-Vinson syndrome. Remember, it's a triad, right? Like iron deficiency anemia, dysphagia, and like the beefy red tongue. And the dysphagia is from the esophageal webs, right? And then ring sideroblasts, right? You can see them in many things like lead poisoning. You can see them in like isoniazid toxicity. Remember, isoniazid depletes your B6. And if you deplete your B6, ALE synthase doesn't work as well. If ALE synthase doesn't work as well, you're going to have problems with heme synthesis. If you have a B6 deficiency as well, right, that can cause a sideroblastic anemia. If you have lead poisoning, that can cause a sideroblastic anemia. Your myelodysplastic syndromes can actually also present with sideroblastic anemia. In fact, there is a myelodysplastic syndrome known as RARS. I think it's like refractory anemia with ringed sideroblasts. So again, ringed sideroblasts on histology are not always lead poisoning. They can also be a myelodysplastic syndrome. Lead poisoning, remember, is also associated with like basophilic stippling, right? Because that ribonuclease that helps you essentially break down those ribosomal proteins and like ribosomal RNA is essentially destroyed by the lead, right? So you cannot break down your like your ribosomal RNA. So they sort of show up as like blue stipples in a red blood cell. So I think that's all I'm going to talk about today. I apologize that this is going long, but again, if you listen to all these HemOnc podcasts, you'll be a HemOnc expert, because my goal is to cover essentially everything that is tested on the USMLEs from a HemOnc perspective. So I'll have one more podcast. I'll probably talk about the hemolytic anemias in that podcast, say a few more like basic science things, and then we'll officially be done with HemOnc. So I wish you all the best. It is like 3 a.m. right now, because again, this is just one of those free times I have on a busy medicine service. And as I round up, right, again, I offer one-on-one tutoring for The USML is step 1, step 2 CK, step 2 CS, step 3, the internal medicine in training exam, and also the internal medicine board exams, believe it or not. And then I also offer tutoring for organic chemistry. I do application advising, so like pre-meds going to med school, like for like the AMCAS application, or med students going into residency for the ERAS application, like mock interviews, writing personal statements. I consult for all those things. I have a lot of admissions committee experience. You can private message me and I'll tell you what kind of experience I have. But I have admissions committee experience at a major medical school, one of the best med schools in this country. So I sort of have a lot of experience with that, so I can help you with that process. And then again, if you weirdly have a relative that needs help with organic chemistry, I also offer a tutoring for that, like organic synthesis and all that stuff. So I wish you all the best. Have a great rest of the day, and I will see you in episode 84. Have a wonderful day, and God bless. Thank you.